Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Richard Hayes Phillips, who's written a fascinating book called Witness to a Crime, A Citizen's Audit of an American Election. And basically, of course, it's going into the background of the 2004 election, predominantly in Ohio, where all of the evidence shows that there was a great deal of dishonesty. There were many precincts where there were far more votes than there were registered citizens, and so many of the ballots disappeared. There were so many things that happened that makes it very obvious that this whole election was rigged. And how can we preserve our society with rigged elections? Actually, quotation in the book from Machiavelli, who wrote The Prince, who said that whenever one wishes to reform an existing government in a free state, you should at least try to preserve the semblance of the old forms, so that it may seem to the people that there's been no change in the institutions, even though, in fact, they are entirely different from the old ones. Richard, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you, and that was the most accurate and thoughtful introduction I've had so far, I think.
Well, of course, I enjoyed your book tremendously. And well, why don't you tell, first of all, I know you're a PhD, I know you're a hydrologist. How in heaven's name did you ever get into a situation of beginning to research the criminal activity that took place in Ohio in the 2004 elections?
I didn't mean to. I used to have a life. I had a peaceful life in far upstate New York as a folk musician and a mountain trail maintenance worker and sometimes as a consulting geologist. And 10 days after the election, I received an unsolicited email from a mountaintop in Pennsylvania from someone who had just added me to her list, and it contained obviously false election results from Cuyahoga County. And when I then downloaded the precinct results, I saw extraordinary numbers of votes turning up in the columns of third-party presidential candidates whom I'd never heard of in Cleveland, the number one Democratic stronghold in the state. And I knew that these were carry votes that had shifted to other candidates, and I didn't know why, and I didn't know how, but it made me a witness to a crime, and my mother had taught me that a witness must come forward.
Well, I'm glad that you did. I think one of the most discouraging things for you must have been, though, when you went to a Senator Kerry's office, and that nobody there was really concerned about the fact that the presidency of the United States had been stolen from Senator Kerry.
No, they didn't seem to care. John Kerry himself was AWOL. I believe he was in Iraq on January 6th, 2005. We were in Washington, D.C. in support of the challenge by the late Stephanie Tubbs Jones. And
you're right,
he went into several Senate offices where it was the issue of the day and the phones were ringing off the hook, but John Kerry's people didn't care.
Right. And so you began to get the picture that there was something very strange about what had taken place. And certainly when you see you have far more votes in a precinct than there are registered voters, you don't have to be very smart to realize that somebody has rigged these elections. I remember that in this one county, one precinct, the explanation was, well, the voting machine had a hiccup. And everybody said, oh, well, that was it. The voting machine had a hiccup. I thought you made an excellent point. You said there's only three reasons for using electronic voting machines: to make money for the people, Diebold and the other manufacturers, to get a quick results, and, of course, to fix an election. We're going to be back in just a moment with Richard Hayes Phillips. Well, Richard, you picked the story up from there because you know it far better than I do.
Well, in the early days, I was looking at precinct results with much help from people who knew how to turn election records into tables and spreadsheets so that I could analyze them. And the idea was to challenge the election in the Ohio State Supreme Court. I testified for 4 hours under oath, and we never did get a hearing. Under Ohio law, the Chief Justice, all by his lonesome, gets to decide whether or not to hear an election challenge. And given that we were also challenging the election of Chief Justice Moyer, it seemed like the appearance of impropriety for him to be able to dismiss the challenge. Among the things that we found early on, there were not just 155,000 provisional ballots, but 93,000 uncounted regular ballots, people who voted not provisionally, whose votes had not been counted for president at the time that Senator Kerry conceded. That's almost a quarter of a million votes. And these uncounted ballots were heavily concentrated in precincts that had voted overwhelmingly for Kerry. Not all of them, but far disproportionately. It mattered where these votes came from, and it mattered why those ballots weren't counted. We investigated the withholding of voting machines in Franklin County. 122 voting machines never delivered to any polling place whatsoever. Most of them withheld from Columbus, the number one Democratic stronghold in the county. This was the cause of lines 4 hours long with people standing in a cold rain, either waiting to vote or having to walk away because they couldn't wait that long because perhaps they had a job. And the director of the Board of Elections in Franklin County, Matthew Dan Schroeder, who was also the former Republican Party chairman in Franklin County, actually stated under oath that all the machines were deployed, but they weren't. 122 not delivered. We saw many complaints in Youngstown, Ohio.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment as we pull our stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Richard Hayes Phillips, of course, has his Ph.D. He, of course, works in many fields, of course, beyond, of course, geology, where he's specifically trained in hydrology. Certainly, he is a lyricist. He's a musician. But he was drawn into suddenly trying to evaluate what happened in Ohio simply because nobody else was evaluating it. And was it possible that here in the United States, where we have elections for president every 4 years, this election was fraudulent in Ohio, and George Bush really didn't win the election? Well, of course, as you know, of course, those of us who listen to our programs regularly know that there was a very close relationship between John Kerry and George Bush. And so John Kerry, on the morning after the election, when it was obvious that there were well over 100,000 votes that hadn't been counted, and there was only 100,000 votes between the two candidates, difference in votes, I think 136,000 more votes for Bush. John Kerry simply concedes the election and refuses to challenge it, and there are all sorts of things going on. There's the failure to deliver the electronic voting machines in certain areas, so people have to wait 4 or 5 hours in drizzling rain to try to get the chance to elect, and where so many of these things are happening are the Democrat counties. And there's so many improprieties. You pick up, discuss some of the others, because they used different techniques to rig the elections in almost every county, didn't they?
Yes, and that's the thing that shocks my listeners the most, the many different methods to rig this election. I started to say that in Youngstown, there were many complaints from voters who would vote on the touchscreen electronic voting machines and watch their vote for Kerry hop to Bush. And the Board of Elections themselves reported this on election night. In one of these precincts where this happened, there were also voters who never had a chance to vote for president. The choice never came up on the screen. But when I looked at the election results, there were no undervotes. Everyone who touched the screen had a vote recorded for president, even if they never saw a choice appear on the screen. Those machines were programmed to default to Bush. The default choice should be no vote at all. And there's nothing to audit. I mean, the reason we were able to prove fraud in Ohio in 2004 is because 85% of the votes were cast on paper. 70% on punch cards, 15% on optical scanners that read a paper ballot. Only 15% were cast on electronic voting machines. Now there are many states in the union where most of the votes are cast on electronic voting machines, where only a highly skilled computer technician can possibly audit the election. I can't do it. Most Americans can't do it.
Fortunately,
if I can't see a paper ballot, I can't audit it.
Well, fortunately, here in California, the new Democratic Secretary of State, only time I've ever voted for a Democrat, although I voted for this Secretary of State here in California in 2004, because she said she was going to check out the electronic voting machines. She had them checked out. She said they could all be rigged and that they should not be used here in the largest state of the union. So at least, of course, there is some hope, that people are beginning to understand the electronic voting machines are rigged and there's no way you can keep them from being rigged. And certainly once, of course, if you don't have a paper ballot, you have no way of checking it. Now, according to your book, you or the people working with you had gone over 126,000 ballots. What was that all about?
We either examined or actually photographed 126,000 ballots and 127 poll books and 141 voter signature books in 18 counties in Ohio. What I was going to say is that it wasn't until the spring of 2006, about a year and a half after the election, that the Attorney General of the State of Ohio ruled that the ballots were, in fact, public record. And this is important to understand, too. You can't just walk into a Board of Elections and look at the ballots and see if they were counted correctly. And even if you do that, if you can't look at the voter signature books, then you don't know if the right number of ballots are in the stack. You don't know if the right number of votes were even counted, let alone whether or not they went to the right candidates. So for people who want to believe that our elections will be honest because we're voting on paper and it's being fed through an optical scanner, or we have an electronic machine that has a paper trail that we're supposed to look at and verify before we push send on the computer. Nobody's going to get to look at that paper. Even today, later this month, I am to give an election auditing workshop at the University of Montana, and I have been told by the Board of Elections and the Secretary of State that I can't look at the ballots, and I can't look at the poll books. They're sealed up. I would need a court order. These are not our elections. We don't have control over them anymore.
And that's a great tragedy, but most Americans honestly believe that, of course, we have an electoral process. We do not. We have a process that will elect the people that the establishment wants elected, and it's about time the American people understood how this concept really works. We used to have free elections, no longer. Now, basically, you actually had to get court orders to actually see a lot of these ballots and get what you had.
Not in Ohio. We would have needed a court order in the first year and a half.
All right.
But as of the spring in 2006, the Attorney General ruled that we could see the ballots. But even then, we had to fight to get them, the most notorious example being Delaware County, Ohio, where not once, not twice, but five times, armed, uniformed, paramilitary policemen were called out to try to stop us from looking at ballots.
Would you repeat that again? Because I read that,
yeah.
Five times armed paramilitary police were called out to block the efforts to get to the bottom of this. I mean, that is incredible. I mean, that's the sort of things that would happen in Nazi Germany.
Yeah. Yeah, or Nazi Germany, exactly. It made me wonder what country I was in.
Well, basically, of course, how did you counter them? After all, they've got the weapons. They have the power of law behind them.
I'm a fearless man. I don't need courage. I lack fear. Whether that's a genetic quality or a genetic defect, I don't know. But I simply walked up to the man and looked at his shoulder patch and found out who he was working for. And when I got back to the law office, I did an internet search on Global Security Services, and their own web page boasted that they were comprised of former Secret Service and FBI agents, CIA operatives, and special military operatives such as Navy SEALs. That's who the Delaware County, Ohio Board of Elections felt they needed to protect them from the likes of us, private citizens wanting to look at public records.
But you had that right at that time to actually look at the records, didn't you?
We certainly did.
And so
we eventually got them.
What did you actually do to counter that, of course? And how were you able to just say, well, you're violating the law. You do not have the right to bring in armed paramilitary police. People who want to, of course, check out the validity of the elections. After all, that's the very essence of our society.
Indeed. And this was based on public records requests we had made where we even specified the precincts in advance. Now, one of my colleagues felt that these officers were not so much worried about us as they were lookouts for the Board of Elections, and that maybe some ballot tampering was going on. And I had the opportunity to pull a switcheroo in my records request and change the precincts I had asked for with less than 24 hours notice. And they didn't pick up on this. And the Board of Elections put the punch cards for Precinct Genoa I on the table as requested one morning with no opportunity to go and check the stacks of cards and make sure that everything was going to survive an audit. And we found those ballots sorted according to presidential candidate. And there were three decks of cards, and the third one was all for Bush, 359 consecutive ballots for Bush. That is not the sequence in which voters dropped those ballots into the ballot box on election night. Somebody had unauthorized access to those ballots, and we found 212 ballots in a row in Butler County, Ohio as well, another heavily Republican county, and again, ballots sorted according to presidential candidate with long, long runs for President Bush. And in fact, we know what happened there. A ranking employee of the Board of Elections told us that the punch cards had always worked well for them and they'd always done their own programming, but for some reason on the morning of election day, a technician from the ES&S voting machine company showed up unannounced at the Board of Elections and reprogrammed all six of their tabulators. And that could be why a count of the ballots that we photographed in precinct after precinct after precinct fails to match the tabulator.
And because it must be rather discouraging for people out there, idealistic people who honestly believe that we have an electoral process. After all, we've just witnessed the Democrat convention and all the balloons and all the enthusiasm. Now we're watching the Republican, of course, convention and all the balloons and all the enthusiasm. Ladies and gentlemen, it's all showbiz. And you must understand that, I mean, I did not like John Kerry one iota, but I believe he won the elections. Just I believe Al Gore won the election in the year 2000. But, of course, the people who really run this country wanted George Bush in there. Why? Well, of course, look what he's done. What a great job he's done for America. I mean, we've accumulated more debt with George Bush in office and all of the other presidents throughout all history combined, or just about. I mean, we've gone from about $5.6 trillion up to well over $10 trillion, probably be about $10.3 or $10.4 trillion before he gets out of office. And basically, there's no better way to destroy a nation than to botch the currency. And believe me, George Bush does not run anything. He simply takes orders from the people behind the scenes. And they wanted a Republican there. He's done more to destroy and undermine the Republican Party than any other person I know throughout all history. But what we need is honest elections. How are we going to get them? Well, I hope Rich is going to have some answers to that.
Sure.
If you have a question, give us a call. Well, I guess it's Richard Hayes Phillips, and go right ahead. Why don't you tell us what else you found? Because you just found so many improprieties.
Oh, sure. And you know, one of the things we noticed early on is that there were 12 counties in southwestern Ohio where John Kerry was getting fewer votes than down-ticket Democratic candidates who were little known and little funded. This doesn't happen in close elections. The presidential race was close. The race for Ohio Chief Justice was close. But roughly, for every 10 people who voted for president, only 8 people voted for Chief Justice. You would expect the presidential candidates to get more votes than the Chief Justice candidates, and that is not what happened in southwestern Ohio. You had John Kerry running behind Ellen Connolly, a little-known, underfunded African-American municipal judge from Cleveland who had never run a countywide race, never set foot in southwestern Ohio, had no campaign in southwestern Ohio, had not one yard sign in southwestern Ohio, spent one nickel per vote received in the state of Ohio, and Kerry can't get as many votes as she. Nor could he get as many votes as Al Gore had gotten in 2000, despite the very large increase in turnout. Which is to say that Bush got all the new voters, all the Nader voters, and some of the Gore voters, or the equivalent. Well, when we started looking at the ballots, in 4 of those counties, we found in nearly every precinct audited, we photographed more ballots than the total number issued to the voters.
Please repeat that again. In other words, there are more.
We photographed more ballots than the total number issued.
But how could you do that if you only issue so many ballots? How could you end up with more ballots than had actually been issued?
Some of them were never touched by voters.
Right.
And if some of the ballots are fake, how do we know that any of the ballots are real? And we're not talking just one or two more where maybe somebody forgot to sign the register. We would find as many as 24 extra ballots in a precinct. In an election that was decided by 11 votes per precinct. And this is just one method of vote rigging called ballot box stuffing. When we looked at the actual ballots, we would find absolutely inexplicable choices attributed to the same voters on the same day. We would find, for instance, that 60%, even 70%, of the ballots punched for Ellen Connolly, for a liberal black judge from Cleveland, for Chief Justice, were also punched for Bush. I don't think anybody believes that 2/3 of Ellen Connolly's voters were secret admirers of George W. Bush. We would also find that most, more than half, more than 50% of the ballots punched in favor of homosexual marriage were also punched for Bush.
I thought that was such an interesting thing.
Yeah,
because the people who would be voting in favor of homosexual marriage would not be voting for George Bush.
Not most of them. Some of them would, but not. It's certainly not true that if you are a champion of homosexual marriage, or at least willing to tolerate it and not write a ban into the Constitution, that you are more likely to vote for Bush than Kerry. That simply didn't happen. And this is what we would find when we'd analyze the ballots. And how could this happen? Well, I'll tell you how it happened in Warren County, Ohio. Independent observers didn't get to watch the votes being counted in Warren County, Ohio.
Hold that thought.
Hold that thought, please.
We're going to bring our stations right on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is Richard Hayes Phillips. He was just saying that, you know, as they began to analyze the votes, they found that in certain areas that there were certainly more votes for her name was Ellen Conway, I believe it was. She was running for the Chief Justice of Ohio. And, of course, she was getting a much larger number of votes than John Kerry. In areas where she hadn't campaigned, why would people be voting for a relatively unknown black woman for Supreme Court Justice, and not voting for John Kerry, who, of course, would be liberal? okay, all the liberal credentials. And then, of course, the fact that the people who are voting in favor of gay marriage were also voting for George Bush. I mean, that's totally incongruous. The people who are voting for gay marriage, to legalize gay marriage, would have been voting for John Kerry, unless somebody had actually rigged the votes. And you were just beginning to tell us how this was done.
Yeah, the most cloak and dagger story in Ohio is certainly Warren County. Ordinarily, they report their election results rather early. This is outside of Cincinnati, a county that borders Hamilton. And it was midnight. They still hadn't reported their results. So a young reporter from the Cincinnati Enquirer drove up there to find out why not, and they had the building locked down under a phony level 10 terrorist threat homeland security alert. The county building was surrounded by police cars, bomb-sniffing dogs. The reporter observed ballots being brought in the back door as late as 12:30 in the morning. She then investigated and found out that neither the FBI nor the state government had any knowledge of any terrorist threat in any county in Ohio. She then found emails back and forth between two county officials 7 and 8 days before Election Day planning the lockdown in advance. Even the wording to be put on the signs posted on the building to keep the reporters out. It was approved behind closed doors by county commissioners 5 days before the election, and the Board of Elections themselves were notified a couple of days before the election that the building was going to be locked down as soon as the polls closed.
So that nobody could actually monitor the voting.
That's correct. And ladies and gentlemen, there is a word for this sort of behavior. It is called conspiracy. And what actually happened, we have eyewitnesses, one of whom drew a map showing us the layout of the buildings, showing us the unauthorized warehouse to which the ballots were brought from the polling places before being brought in the loading dock through the back door to the Board of Elections. And when I looked at the election results, I concluded that the simplest explanation consistent with these bizarre results, Warren County being the only punch card county in Ohio where Kerry got fewer votes than Ellen Connolly, and George Bush got more votes than the ban on gay marriage, what it appeared to me they had done was took a certain number of ballots, say 30 or 40 in each precinct, and shifted them, moved them one precinct up the list. By doing that, a punch for Kerry would be counted as a punch for Bush, because in Ohio, the sequence, the order in which candidates' names appear on the ballot must rotate from precinct to precinct. So if a ballot is punched number 6 for Kerry in precinct 2, and you put it up to precinct 1, that punch will be counted for Bush. And you will damage the entire Democratic ticket because all the two-person races will rotate, but people do split their tickets. Kerry suffers more damage than the down-ticket Democrats and ends up getting fewer votes than Ellen Connolly and some other down-ticket Democrats, and ballot initiatives don't rotate. Yes is above no on every ballot, in every precinct, in every county in Ohio. So you're going to turn gay-friendly Kerry voters into gay-friendly Bush voters and then run the ballots through the tabulator. It was quite inadvertent. But, you know, the terms anomalous or irregular are comparative terms. You've got to compare to something. That's why we did what we would call whole ballot analysis. We'd look at more than one office on the ballot. We found 400 ballots in these 15 audited precincts where they were counted as having voted Republican for every single contested office and punched for gay marriage. Straight ticket gay-friendly Republicans. I don't think so.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand that they've simply compromised our electoral process. Of course, John Kerry adamantly refused to try to get to the bottom of this. Fortunately, I believe it was, the Libertarians and maybe the Green Party that put up the money.
Correct.
And they eventually tried, of course, to get something done there. A couple of people went to prison for trying to rig things, but, of course, the presidential election still stood. And we're in war in Afghanistan, we're at war, and we're soon going to war with Iran. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Richard Hayes Phillips, and we're talking about the rigging of the election there in Ohio. And Richard, how long did you actually spend analyzing that, and what about the expenses? Where did the money come from for your investigation?
Well, you know, the first books arrived in my house on April 12th of this year, so I put in about 3.5 years off and on investigating this. I had some work as a trailblazer and trail maintenance worker. I had a 6-week stint as a consulting geologist. And through various compensation and contributions, I received less than $13,000 for my work in Ohio, and most of my expenses came out of that. Basically, I was tapping into my retirement accounts to finance this investigation. And I had 3 publishers vying for the manuscripts last summer. It was quite an achievement. I'm an unagented author with an unsolicited manuscript and had never been published before. And I sent out letters of inquiry and a sample chapter to 7 publishers and heard back from 3 of them within days. I decided to go with Kent State University Press. 4 days after the first public announcement that the book was under contract, in a page 1 banner headline in my hometown newspaper, they backed out. Sent me an email with enough false statements in it that I don't know why they broke the contract. So already exhausted and traumatized, we then had to do all the typesetting, all the formatting, all the editing, all the graphics, and come up with $26,000 to put this book out ourselves in a hard copy cloth cover edition, which therefore is not available in the stores. It is only available at my speaking engagements or through the mail by personal check or money order or through PayPal, all of that through my own website, witnesstoacrime.com. So I'm now struggling just to make the money back on this investigation. I do have appearances coming up in Northern California. The largest venue being the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland at 7 o'clock on Tuesday. It hasn't had the publicity that it really needs, and so I do hope for a surprising turnout. But I have, with the book includes a CD with 1,200 photographs of evidence from Ohio, including altered ballots and altered signature books. And I show about 50
Hold that thought for just a minute here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Richard Hayes Phillips has done a wonderful job. He's, of course, had to self-publish his book. He had a contract with Kent State University, but for some reason, at the last minute, they backed out. Did they give you any compensation when they backed out of their contract?
Oh, no. The total compensation I've gotten from Kent State University Press was took me out to lunch twice and gave me 2 copies of a beautiful book called Our Native Trees.
All right, well, first of all, let's go ahead. You were mentioning you're going to be speaking at the Grand Lake Theater. I remember the Grand Lake Theater there.
Yeah.
Right next to Lake Merritt. I was born and raised in Oakland. Great. When are you going to be speaking there, and how can people get to hear you talk? Tuesday, September 9th.
And, at 7 o'clock p.m., yeah.
Is there a telephone number people could call if they're interested in going?
I don't have it with me. I'd have to go upstairs.
But can they simply go to the theater and get in there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The tickets run sale already, and then people will be able to get tickets at the door as well. And I'll have books that I will sell and autograph and personalize as well. And I'll give my slide presentation. And it's very likely that there will be some clips from Dorothy Fadiman's film, Stealing America, Vote by Vote. I just heard from her today on this point, so I have offered to give her maybe a half an hour before my presentation to show some of the best clips from her movie, which I've already had the privilege of seeing. And a lot of that has to deal with Ohio as well.
Well, let's go ahead. First of all, let's get out your webpage so people would know how they get in touch with
yes.
you. What is your webpage?
Well, my website is Witness to a Crime.
WitnessToACrime.com. Okay.
I was very lucky to get that address. And if you go to the table of contents, you will see upcoming events, and you can click on it. Actually, I have a 7-state tour coming up, starting on Monday. And because I live in northern New York, and I have a tour of California, Oregon, Washington, Montana, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. And then I will return home, possibly do some dates in Connecticut, and then have a tour of the Midwest before Election Day.
Now, are you scheduling the tour yourself, or do you have certain local groups that are trying to get the truth out?
Well, I have local groups that will sponsor the events, but basically I'm the publicist, the booking agent, the travel agent, and the advance man. So I've had to learn a lot of different tasks in the process of getting this book out to the public and letting them know about it. And I've been dependent on alternative radio shows because there's been almost no mainstream media coverage of this. There seems to be a blackout in the media and in the publishing industry. Nobody seems to want to talk about this. And, you know, to me, it's very grievous. If we don't have the right to vote and have our votes counted as cast, then I don't see that we have any peaceful means of redress.
No, I really...
And I'm not a violent man.
I know.
I want a peaceful option.
I know, but unfortunately, the average individual, as long as times are good, he's not going to be too concerned about this. He's going to be more concerned about who's going to be the quarterback for the 49ers or who's going to win the World Series here, you know, and will our local teams here and the Oakland A's or the San Francisco Giants, you know, be in the playoffs. And they're really unconcerned about the fact that our freedom is being stripped from us and we are sending our troops throughout the world as we consolidate the American empire, and that there are people who run our country who do not believe in the electoral process, but of course go through the actions and have the conventions every 4 years. It's great showbiz. Well, our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to talk to our special guest this evening, of course, William Hayes Phillips. On that DVD, I haven't had a chance to look at the DVD. Is that going to have your slideshow on it, or would that be a...
Well, it's a little different. The slideshow culls about 60 photographs from the CD. The CD contains 1,200 photographs culled from our digital archives of about 30,000 photographs that we took in Ohio. And some of these photos have 10 or 12 punch card ballots on one photo. We have a massive archives of evidence from Ohio. And so we show the most compelling evidence organized into folders with caption and keyed to the pages in the text. And I'm putting the evidence out there. This is a very methodical, relentless book, laying out the case in detail. It should be a lawyer's dream. And I felt that the narrative would not be believed without the tables of raw data, and that the numbers would not be believed without the photographs of evidence. So we put it all out there in the beginning.
And, of course, you make the point that the major parties are obsolete, so the Republicans know they stole the election, the Democrats knew they stole the election, and the Democrat Party absolutely refused to do anything about it. It took the Libertarians and the Green Party at least to try to get something in Ohio. It didn't matter, because even though it was crooked, it was demonstrated it was crooked and fraudulent, why, of course, a couple of people went to jail for a short period of time. And millions, probably a million, have died in Iraq, certainly. And how many have died in Afghanistan? How many more are going to die in the coming war with Iran and with the Muslim world? And all because, of course, we did not get honest elections. And I think the American people, I don't like either candidate from my point of view, whether it be Bush or Kerry. But, of course, had they elected Kerry, perhaps things would not have gone as badly as they have. Maybe they would have gone just as badly. The thing is that they stole the election. Right. We will never know.
Yeah, so, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who really would have won the election. The fact is we didn't get an honest count.
I think that is the point
that
you're making.
And that's exactly it. The loser can win and the winner can lose, and this is totally unacceptable in the United States of America. There is a comfort zone that Americans like to slink into where they say, oh, I'm sure that both parties do this equally and it all evens out. Well, that wasn't the case in Ohio. I investigated both red counties and blue counties. I found red counties rigged for Bush, and I found blue counties rigged for Bush. What I found was different methodologies. For instance, in the blue counties, in the heavily Democratic inner-city precincts, ballot rotation was used in a different way. There, especially in Cleveland, multiple precincts would vote in the same polling place with different rotations, with the candidates' names listed in different sequence in each precinct. And so if voters went to the shortest line or to a vacant booth and it wasn't a machine set up for their precinct, they would think they were punching for Kerry, but that vote would be counted for another candidate. That was the first thing I saw in the election results that I knew was false, and it wasn't until we looked at the ballots that we could prove what happened. We have photographic proof that in Cleveland, Kerry votes were shifted to Badnarik, Perutka, Nader, and Bush. These are votes not counted as cast. But it's not just Ohio. A lot of people investigated New Mexico and concluded that New Mexico was rigged as well. This year, on the night of the Ohio primary, I thought, you know, everybody's going to be looking at Ohio. Maybe I should look at the results from Texas instead and see what I find. And you know what I found? There were 21 counties in Texas this year, 2008, in West Texas, where you weren't allowed to take a Republican ballot in the presidential primary. You had to vote Democratic or not at all. And that is wrong. That disenfranchises oil patch workers and ranchers in West Texas who wanted to vote for Ron Paul or John McCain or Mike Huckabee. And they weren't allowed to. And that's wrong. And now that it looks like voters in either party can be affected depending on where they live, maybe America will rise up. It's not a Democratic problem and a Republican problem. It's not a matter of right and left. It's a matter of right and wrong.
A very, very good point and very good phrase. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there in the listening audience, are you concerned about the fact that the election process in the United States is fraudulent? And in many areas, you don't know whether they're going to be counting your votes. And certainly the one thing I think that Richard makes the point he makes is we've got to have a paper trail and forget about the electronic voting machines. After all, they can rig these electronic voting machines any way they want to. You've got to have a paper trail so that you know how people really vote. And people have to be held responsible. And, of course, I think that anybody who works in the electoral process and is convicted of fraud ought to be put in prison for the rest of their life because, of course, they have destroyed the very essence of our country. Maybe that's a little bit too bad. Maybe just give them 10 years in prison and $1 million fine. But, of course, a lot of these are party supporters. You point out, of course, that the man who is in charge of the electoral process in the state of Ohio was basically a known active Bush supporter. Is that right?
That is correct. J. Kenneth Blackwell was the Secretary of State and was also the state co-chair of the Bush-Cheney re-election campaign.
In fact, we saw that in the 2000 election. But
Catherine Harris.
And, of course, she was rewarded by being allowed to run for Congress.
Right.
As a direct result, of course, she was rewarded because she certified that Bush won there. And, of course, they did everything, including what I think is totally unjust, and that is taking the case to the Supreme Court. Where in the Constitution does the Supreme Court have anything to do with state elections? It doesn't have that. But Well, of course, they wanted, they knew that they had a friendly court who would go right along with the agenda of putting George Bush into the presidency. And so until people understand that we've got to abide by the law and you can't change the rules and regulations whenever it suits you, and of course taking the case to the Supreme Court is how Al Gore lost. Now, I think Al Gore is a detestable individual, but that has nothing to do with whether I like John Al Gore or I like John Kerry. I think that the election process is rigged. And let's go to Jack, who's calling from Michigan. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Jack, do you have a question for our guest?
Indeed, Dr. Stan. This is a fiery issue that ought to unite everyone in and out of government. I wanted to ask the guest whether the book, Witness to a Crime, delineates a uniform pattern of election fraud throughout the county system, and whether there is a delineated delineated process in his book by which one can pursue accountability.
All right, fine. Sydney, how would you respond to that, Richard?
No, there was a different story in every county, so I ended up doing about 20 separate investigations.
And I think that's really what's so important. Richard was told when he first got started at this that they would use a different technique in every county, and that's really what he found. There were so many different techniques, whether it was rigging the voting machines, not having any voting machines. I mean, all this idea of putting people into different precincts so the votes would be counted differently. There are these probably, 20 different techniques of rigging these ballots that they use?
I think that's about right, because I looked at about 20 different counties, and those are the old-fashioned methods of voter intimidation, voter suppression, purging the voter rolls, breaking into the Democratic headquarters in Toledo and stealing their computers with all the campaign information on it. I mean, the old methods were used, too. But, I looked, for instance, let's talk about optical scanners. That's what California's got. I looked at two counties that used optical scanners, and I found in both cases ballots altered before being run through the scanner. In Claremont County, there were little white stickers put over the mark for Kerry and the mark for Bush filled in. In Miami County, we would find ballots with no choice for president, and somebody had filled them in for Bush. So they'd be counted as a vote for Bush in a hand clearly different than that for the rest of the marks on the ballot. There was a different method in every county. What we need is paper ballots counted by hand at the polling place in full public view on election night, no matter how long it takes.
Amen to that. And that, I think, is so apropos. And people have to understand that it does not matter whether we have to wait a few more hours to find out who won the presidency. What we want is an honest vote, and we're not getting it. Anything else you want to ask, Jack, before we let you go?
Yeah, where in Michigan do you live?
The not-so-thriving metropolis of Flint.
Okay, fine.
Because I just got an invitation tonight to come to the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor on Sunday the 19th of October, and I'm going to try to get bookings in other cities in Michigan shortly thereafter, as long as I'm there.
Hey, you know what? There's a university that used to be General Motors Institute. It's now called Kettering.
And
I guess there's a king from Sweden, Gustav, that's supposed to be visiting Kettering. Maybe I can call them and see if they can. You'll have to give out a contact number.
Well, I'll tell you what, you get in touch with me.
You'll find that on my website, witnessofcrime.com. If you go to the page that says buy it now, it gives you my contact information.
Okay, we got to go because we've got other callers. Thanks very much, Jack. Let's go to Joe, who's also calling from Michigan. Hi, Joe. How you doing?
How you doing? A simple question. I try to explain this to people, and I'm just asking you, what would be the most economical way to explain this to your average individual without being long-winded? Because you tell this to other people, and they look at you like you're crazy,
Okay, how would you try to convince? I think probably I'd like to know what Richard says, but I think the best way is, can you explain to me how you would have one precinct with 800 people in it and 1,200 votes for George Bush? How could you do that? Could you explain to me?
Yeah, there was one precinct with 600 ballots cast and over 4,000 of them went for Bush.
Okay.
That was electronic voting. They corrected it. How do you correct it? There's no paper. How did they come up with the different numbers? That's Franklin County.
It was 400. What do you mean? The 400.
I don't recall the numbers exactly. I think it was over 600 ballots cast, and I believe Bush got 4,258 of them.
All right, fine. That's Joe. Yeah. That's what you do.
That's an example there. But then you would, how do you explain the counties that we audited where every single precinct we looked at had extra ballots? What's with extra ballots? More ballots?
Yeah, but that's
the total number issued to the voters, and that's why you can't just recount the ballots. You have to start with the voter signature books and find out how many ballots you're supposed to have. That's an audit. There's a paper on my website called What Constitutes an Election Audit. This isn't a recount. This isn't a spot check. When the IRS audits your taxes, you don't get to decide what papers to provide. They want to see it all. And that's what I try to do, too. But how do you explain to people that it's not, I can't say in 2 minutes a convincing case that our elections are rigged because they use so many different methods.
I know, it's so twisted. That's the hard part about explaining any of this stuff.
Yeah.
But ask questions, Joe. Try to get them to think. The trouble is that people are not thinking, and if we've got to get them thinking, that's the only way we're going to be able to save America. God bless, and thanks very much for calling. We do have Sean from Spokane. We'll get to Sean in just a moment here during the break. But our guest this evening has been Richard Hayes Phillips. And, of course, he's going to be speaking at the Grand Avenue Theater in Oakland next Tuesday. And anyway, he's done a wonderful job, his book, A Witness to a Crime. Ladies and gentlemen, it was criminal, and an awful lot of people have died because of it. Well, we've got Sidney Richard Hayes Phillips with us, and let's go to Sean, who's calling us from Spokane. Hi, Sean, how are you doing?
Pretty good, Dr. Stan. How are you?
Doing fine. You have a question for our guest?
I just wanted to make a comment about what you were talking about. I mean, as far as, Al Gore being ripped off, I mean, he basically walked away, straight away.
Neither he nor John Kerry really challenged the election because both of them knew the fix was in, both of them are part and parcel of this hidden establishment that runs the country, and they knew George Bush would do more to destroy the Republican Party than any man president we've had, in the last 100 years. But they were in on the fix as well, so don't feel sorry.
I totally agree. I mean, you can go onto YouTube and watch him where the vice president's the chief of the house, where you've got Democrats standing up there, making a spiel against how they got ripped off in the election, and there's Al Gore banging his hammer, telling them to sit down and shut up.
Right.
And that's right there on YouTube. People can see it for themselves. You can see where he basically gave up the election before he was even challenged. He could have challenged every precinct, every area in Florida, but he chose not to.
Right.
What did he get rewarded with? Now he's the high priest of global warming.
Right, he got a Nobel Prize. He's made a lot of money. He's actually, of course, has a company now that sells carbon credits, and he's made millions in that. So, I mean, they all are rewarded for their skullduggery.
Exactly.
Do you have anything? Do you have a question for our guest at all, Sean, before we let you go?
I mean, I just had made that comment because, my big thing is I agree with you. You've got to get both people to understand that it's the right wing and the left wing are the same bird.
Yep, absolutely.
That we're fighting against, and we have to expose it as that. And, people can see it for themselves. There's a lot of people out there that say that Gore was ripped off. And maybe he was, but, he let it go.
Right. He did fight for six weeks, and he would have lost in the House of Representatives. Under the Constitution, every delegation gets one vote. Wyoming gets as many votes as California when they're choosing the president, but that's still no excuse for not fighting it. He had the opportunity to expose what happened. That's what you're saying.
He did. Obviously, he did, but it wasn't on the agenda for him to do that. He had other plans.
You're absolutely right, Sean. We're out of time. God bless. Thanks for calling.
And, you know, I will be passing through Spokane on Saturday the 20th of September in the evening, and we've asked six or eight different groups, and nobody wants to sponsor
an event.
Email me if you know somebody who wants me to stop by, even a private gathering. I'd love to do it.
We'll get you on our afternoon program. It's heard in Spokane every afternoon. God bless. Thanks very much for being with us. Well, this is a fascinating program. I hope you enjoyed it. Richard Hayes Phillips, and of course his book is Witness to a Crime. I think we're actually going to carry the book. I think it's a very important book. And you have to understand that the elections are rigged in the United States. But remember how things were, and remember, of course, if we had an electoral process that was honest. And it wasn't that the dark spiritual forces weren't working there and the corrupt political organizations weren't working there, but they just weren't as blatant as they have been in the last two elections. So that you need to get the information. We're going to put together a four-tape set, I think, very, very soon on the electoral process, and we want you to help us get it out. Get people to understand that because they're not involved, people are dying in the Middle East, and I fear that before long they're going to be dying here in America. Understand that there have been secret spy cells working at the highest echelons of our government with the full knowledge of the FBI and the State Department that have been shipping nuclear technology and information to Pakistan so they could build their nuclear bombs and share them with Iran and the other countries in preparation for the coming war with the Muslim world. That's the Sybil Edmonds story, the Tinner Files, T-I-N-N-E-R Files. Sybil Edmonds story, you can find it up on the Internet, specifically the London Times article on January 8, 2008. London Times, January 2008, Sybil, S-I-B-E-L, Edmonds, E-D-M-O-N-D-S. You need to get the information. You need to help us get it out across America. And then to understand how it all fits together, you need to get our book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. The Brotherhood of Darkness, which will tell you why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools. Everybody knew they did, but why did they do it? And then, of course, you need to get my talk on the forbidden secret and secret knowledge, and certainly the syllabus that goes with the forbidden secret. You need to get my talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that. You need to get our talk on Iraq, the untold story, and the syllabus that goes with that. Our talk on sustainable development, the four-tape set on sustainable development, and the syllabus that goes with that. For those of you, of course, remember our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. I will be speaking at the Yurok Convention in Monrovia in Southern California on Saturday. If you're interested in information on that meeting, why, you can give us a call at 1-800, and we'll get back to you and let you know how you can make arrangements to go to the conference. That's in Yurok Convention on Saturday, all-day convention. Certainly our good friend William Federer, Patrick Wood are going to be speaking as well. Should be an exciting time. And then, of course, we want to remind you about the all-day conference that's going to be held here on October 26th, the Radio Liberty Annual Seminar. And, of course, start early in the morning, go late in the evening. Dr. Russell Blaylock, Joanna Michelson, Patrick Wood will be here. Of course, Michael Shaw will be speaking. And if you'd like to come, we have to have reservations. That's the 26th of October. And, of course, we have special rooms lined up at a local hotel. If you will be staying overnight, which many people will, coming from across the country. Our address, again, is our telephone number, again, I should say, is 1-800-544-8927 to get your reservation in, because we will be serving a delicious lunch, as we always do. And certainly the people who have come back, we had almost 150 last year. We hope to top that number this year. And then, of course, we do hope that you go to our website, radioliberty.com. RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our live radio programs, our archived radio programs. You can listen to our MP3 programs, our blog programs. You can listen to certainly the satellite feed, where you can listen to Radio Liberty 9 hours a day and Joyce Riley 9 hours a day. And then, of course, you can read our newsletters. The list of the books and the other items, four tape sets, CD sets, videos, DVDs are all listed there. You need to get the information. start making preparations for the difficult times that lie ahead. If you'd like information on the health products, if you'd like information on certainly on the food, emergency food, the Berkey water fillers, the things that you will need for the difficult times that lie ahead, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America, pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But the battle rival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, former editor of the New American Magazine, and now working with the Welsh Foundation, writer, puts up a regular blog, maintains their blog site, and, of course, always a pleasure to have him with us. William, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, thanks for having me on again.
All right, fine. Well, of course, what do you want to talk about? I saw you've written an article on Susan Palin.
Yeah, I would like to talk about the Palin nomination. I think that's an important part of what's happening right now. I also wanted to point out that because I'm not going to be with you tomorrow, that tomorrow, September 5th, is Jury Rights Day, which is an observance that is widely ignored but very important, because the jury in the Anglo-Saxon tradition has plenary authority to decide the justice, not only to decide the facts of the case and whether a defendant is innocent or guilty, whether the case against the defendant has been proven by the state, but also to make a ruling with respect to the justice of the law being applied. That's something that was widely practiced in Anglo-American tradition up until very recently, and now, of course, juries are expected to ratify the decisions that a judge is crafting on behalf of the prosecutor in most circumstances. Certainly in federal court, that's the case. And one of the few remaining institutions we have that provide hope for restoration of individual rights in the face of the Leviathan state is the jury, the fully informed jury. It's an exercise of direct democracy, which, of course, is something that's very dangerous. And, of course, you can have injustices through jury nullification, too. People who are innocent can be acquitted by juries who are incorrigible.
Now, you mean people who are guilty might be acquitted, right?
Yeah, people who are guilty can be acquitted. You know, the innocent may be unjustly convicted by juries that are inattentive or biased against the defendant, but you can have as well injustices where the guilty are improperly acquitted. But it's important to recognize that the function of the jury is to see that justice is done, that the government proves its case, and also to make a ruling with respect to the fundamental justice or lack thereof of a given ordinance or law that's being enforced. And September 5th is Jury Rights Day. I just wanted to make that known and to make our listeners aware that that's an important part of the package that we have to pursue if we're going to do something about restoring our individual rights. Now, with respect to the Sarah Palin nomination, I do think that it's a real tragedy on one level that you have somebody who comes out of a background that is, I think, to the extent that you have in politics a maverick, somebody like a Sarah Palin could qualify for that title. Her background is one of Western independence, of individualism, of eccentricity in a way that's really quite engaging in many ways. Her family seems to exhibit many of the traits that we have come to expect from people who live in this part of the country. They're outdoor-oriented. They like hunting. They like outdoor sports. Whether you're talking about fishing or hunting, snowmobile racing, all this is very engaging. The fact that she and her husband started and operated businesses is worthwhile. And now she's being used as a stalking horse.
Well, Chris, I mean, she is simply being used in this whole process, but purely from a political point of view, it really was a great issue because, of course, the women, I hate to say this, but the women are going to vote for Sarah Palin because she's a woman. And there are a lot of Christian conservatives who are going to vote for her because she professes to be a Christian conservative. And John McCain had lost the conservative vote really largely in the Republican Party. They were going to go elsewhere. The people who had the philosophy of Ron Paul. And of course, Sarah Palin has rejuvenated the McCain candidacy. But anyway, we'll get your views on this when we get back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty.
From what I understand, about 2 years ago, before, if I remember correctly, she was elected governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin expressed some misgivings about the war in Iraq and talked about the need for a firm exit strategy. This was at a time when most Republicans were still of the opinion that talking about an exit strategy was tantamount to defeatism, and of course now, by way of necessity, political necessity if nothing else, the Republican Party, beginning with the Bush administration, has talked about the idea of having some kind of a date certain, if not a date certain, at least some kind of a time horizon for withdrawal from Iraq. And Sarah Palin in 2006 was making noises of that sort. She seemed to think that there was a case to be made for beginning to wind down our involvement in Iraq. And in recent years, after she's gotten more firmly embedded in the Republican machinery, her views on this issue have become more conventional, in an unfortunate sense, meaning that her views have become more reconcilable with those of the neocons who are running the Bush administration. And I think that it's by no means insignificant that one of the few themes she has really promoted, apart from the idea of developing the energy resources in Alaska and offshore as a way of reducing our country's dependence on foreign oil, one of the few themes that she's really hammered is the idea of quote-unquote victory in Iraq. And, of course, victory in a war that's fundamentally misbegotten and consummately immoral is something that we really can't achieve. I mean, the only way you can be victorious in that type of a circumstance is to admit your mistake and withdraw, disentangle yourself from the situation as soon as possible. And, of course, that's not something that the Republican Party is willing to countenance right now. On that subject, forgive me for a brief digression here. I think it's really interesting that just tonight, September 4th, Barack Obama has started to talk about how the so-called surge in Iraq is a wild and unqualified success. The so-called surge, of course, represented a dramatic but temporary expansion of the number of troops on the ground in Iraq and the adoption of a different type of occupation strategy where essentially the troops were going to intervene on behalf of Sunni elements within certain sections of the country in order to build a network of support, which meant, of course, that we got involved more deeply in the internecine quarrels of that country. And what Barack Obama has finally said after months of dissimulating on the subject is that he thinks the so-called surge was a wonderful idea, that in practice it's been very successful. And I think that underscores a point that I've made on many occasions with respect to Mr. Obama. He is not a dove. He's not a war critic in the sense that Ron Paul was a critic of the Iraq War, or even Dennis Kucinich on the other side of the aisle. He's always criticized the execution of the war.
And hold that thought for just a moment there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris, Mr. William Grigg is our guest this evening. He's simply pointing out that Osama bin Laden, Hussein Barak has come out. Of course, he's basically Barack Hussein Obama has come out and said that he thinks that the surge was a success. I think I'd just like to intercede for one moment, saying the reason that the surge has worked is not because we put more troops in the ground, mm-hmm. but because we've been bribing the very Sunnis. We've been giving them money. See, you have to understand what really caused the whole problem was when Mr. Bremer, the Council on Foreign Relations, close associate of Kissinger, went over there immediately after the victory, American victory, back in April of 2003, why he disbanded the Iraqi army, he disbanded the Iraqi police force, he disbanded the Iraqi civil service, he closed down the factories so people had no place to work, he closed many of the schools because some of the people there may have belonged to the Ba'athist party, he closed many of the hospitals, and of course now there's no electricity, there's no water, there's no jobs, and so basically, of course, a lot of the people went to work for the terrorists because, of course, they could at least get some money to feed their families. What the Americans have done as part of the surge is simply giving money to the Sunnis, and then I think the Mutqa al-Sadr, the black turbaned head of one of the militias over there, has decided whether he's been bribed or whether he's decided the only way to get rid of the Americans is to stop fighting them, and so they've simply stopped fighting the Americans. And mm-hmm. that's the reason the surge has worked, not because putting a few more troops there. If we'd really wanted to win, we would have sent in 600,000 to 800,000 men. We never went there to win. We went there to create chaos. We really succeeded. We really succeeded in killing an awful lot of Iraqi men, women, and children, and of course, destroying the lives of many of our own men and soldiers. So, but anyway, of course, the fact that Obama is praising the surge now, he ought to be pointing out the reason it's working is because we've simply given jobs to a lot of the Sunnis, that we threw out of jobs 4 years ago. Now we've provided jobs for them in security, working in security and other things, and as long as we keep them giving them money, well, they're not going to join the terrorists again. That's why it's succeeded. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think that's exactly what's happened. I think that's a very good summation, and I really appreciate the fact that you italicized the role of L. Paul Bremer in this. He was, of course, the proconsul who ran the so-called provisional authority there in Iraq after Jay Garner had been the first to carry out the role. Mr. Garner had military experience. As you point out, Jerry Bremer, as he's known, was a very key figure in Kissinger Associates. And that's an important connection here, too, because Kissinger Associates played a really pivotal role in arranging most of the deals that built up Saddam Hussein's army to begin with back in the 1980s. Kissinger Associates helped broker a lot of the slush fund payments that were made to the Iraqi government through the Commodity Credit Corporation, which is, for most people, a somewhat obscure program in the Department of Agriculture. If you're living in Nebraska, it's not obscure. If you're living in Nebraska or in Iowa or Kansas or someplace else in the heartland where there are a lot of farmers who receive federal subsidies, the Triple C, the Commodity Credit Corporation, is by no means obscure. It's probably the most common subsidy that you receive in many sections of the heartland. If you're a bank worker, a bank teller, in that part of the country, you're probably going to see a lot of checks from that agency, but most Americans aren't aware of it. But that was the entity that was used to generate these huge overfunding mechanisms, the surplus of which was used by the Iraqis to go out and buy arms on the open market, including arms manufactured in the United States. And Kissinger Associates was very instrumental in arranging a lot of these loans, working through the Banca di Lavoro, and there was a branch of that bank in Atlanta that was particularly useful as a conduit for that program. And Jerry Bremer was part of the group that arranged for this funding and the buildup of the Iraqi war machine in the 1980s. And then in 2004, he's appointed as the administrator of the occupation that results after we fought a war to beat down the tyrant and the war machine that Washington had built up in the 1980s.
But of course, that's a standard technique, William. I'm sure you're well aware of the fact that it was the United States financiers and the United States State Department government that built up Adolf Hitler and his military before the before the Second World War. It was the American government and the IMF and the World Bank that were building up Russia during the Vietnam War so they could finance the North Vietnamese, so they could kill our boys in South Vietnam. And certainly today we're funding the Pakistani government to the tune of $10 billion, and the Pakistani government's funding the Taliban who are killing our boys in the opium fields of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. When are the American people going to begin to see the pattern? It's like deja vu all over again, mm-hmm. all over again, all over again.
One of the big purposes of this particular presidential race on both sides of the aisle is to obfuscate this reality. As you correctly pointed out, if Obama were a real critic of the policies of the Bush administration, and if he were as perceptive, as percipient as his supporters claim him to be, if he were the blunt-spoken instrument of genuine material change in Washington that he's advertised to be, he would point out the reality behind this grand fraud that is called the surge. He'd say that this is an exercise in mass bribery, that this is part of a long-standing program where the people who govern us will arrange to build up a foreign enemy and then launch a war to tear it down again. In this case, you've got a modification of that strategy by having the army disassembled in Iraq under the administration of Jerry Bremer, and then an army reassembled under David Petraeus. And Mr. Petraeus, the commanding general now in Iraq, is the same one who was in charge of building the security forces in 2005 and 2006, during which time he managed to lose, quote-unquote, about 200,000 small arms and light weapons that are now in the hands of the insurgents who are killing American troops. And, of course, now it's gotten to the point where the two people of whom you cannot speak evil, depending upon which side of the aisle you're inhabiting at a given time, are either Barack Obama for Democrats or David Petraeus for Republicans. I mean, it's gotten to the point now where if you're heard in Republican circles saying anything by way of criticizing David Petraeus, it's considered to be a species of lèse-majeste. Of course, if you say something evil about Barack Obama, the Democratic side is considered to be blasphemy. But this is, of course, all rigged to distract the public from what's really going on, which is this pernicious game of building up a suitable enemy and then tearing down that enemy with great bloodshed and expense and enriching the people who are the puppet masters behind this charade. And Mr. Bremer was a key servant of one such personality, Mr. Kissinger. Mr. Kissinger's got a long pedigree in this terrible, diabolical game. But during the administration of the reconstruction of Iraq under Jerry Bremer, you had countless hundreds of billions of dollars being flooded into Iraq. You had, as I mentioned before, these pallets of freshly minted $100 bills being loaded onto planes, military transport planes in New York City, fresh off the printing press of the Federal Reserve Bank, out of the Mint, by way of the Federal Reserve Bank there in New York, and being shipped over to Iraq, and then bundled up in football-sized shrink-wrapped packages, and literally being thrown off the backs of flatbed trucks to people. You had all kinds of no-bid, cost-added contracts that were handed out to cronies of the power elite, Halliburton and KBR being the most notorious, but there's a whole roster that we could review if we had time. And you had a quick killing being made by these people during this orgiastic festival of cronyism and graft that was the Reconstruction under Bremer, and left the country a perfect ruin. And it cultivated the conditions, uniquely appropriate conditions for an insurgency of the sort that we're now dealing with here. And you've got to wonder if there wasn't an element of design behind this. Of course, you cannot control all the variables in a war. A war is something that really gets out of control very quickly. But it stands to reason that reasonably intelligent people will know what will happen if you disband the army, if you destroy the infrastructure of a country, you leave people without power and water, if you leave people desperate and hungry and penniless, and you have a certain element within that society that receives arms and is well-versed in guerrilla warfare, you can pretty much predict what's going to happen to a certain extent. And so it took no Metternichian genius to realize that in these conditions an insurrection would thrive, that you would have internecine warfare, and you would eventually have a situation where in order to retain order in Iraq, you'd have to have a large, more or less permanent presence of an American occupation force, which is why they're building these bases in Iraq. And this, of course, is all a consummate fraud from the very beginning. their intention was to see these bases in Iraq as a forward positioned land-based staging area to conduct other military enterprises in the region, beginning with Iran, of course. But also, you mentioned Pakistan earlier, Dr. Stan. Pakistan is nuclear in power with an extraordinarily unstable government. They have been sort of the seed reactor, if you will, the breeding reactor for nuclear proliferation, thanks in no small measure to the protection, the political protection that they have received. And now we have sorties being made into Pakistan by American troops in Afghanistan. This is the sort of thing that makes sense, I guess, tactically, or perhaps even in terms of regional strategy, but could get very ugly very quickly. I mean, there are horrible, horrible possibilities that butt off from this conflict there in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border region.
And I think it's so important that this, the American attacks against Pakistan could lead to the overthrow of the current Pakistani government and installation of a radical Islamic government that is now has nuclear weapons. Now, why would you risk something like that? And then why would you have given $10 billion to Pakistan over the last few years when the Pakistani government obviously was financing the Taliban that's killing our boys, financing Al-Qaeda and financing this world terrorist movement right along with our good friends in Saudi Arabia, the major source of funding for Islamic terrorism? But, of course, we wouldn't want to do anything to offend either the Pakistanis or the Saudis. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the old adage, the best enemies money could buy. In fact, I did an interview with Professor Sutton before he passed away, and we called it that, the best enemies money could buy. He'd written a book like that. When are the American people going to understand that if we're building up communist China and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, the best enemies money could buy? Well, William, I want you to go right ahead there.
It's interesting to me that very early in the Democratic primary season, during one of the early debates, Barack Obama made a comment to the effect that we needed to be more aggressive in pursuing Pakistan, that is to say, pressuring Pakistan by way of direct military intervention if necessary. And that, of course, now is the Bush administration position. And then by way of sort of a reciprocal loop on this interdependency between the leader of the Democratic opposition and the Republican Party standard bearers, it's interesting that last night Barack Obama was criticized in Sarah Palin's address, talking about how he supposedly wants to forfeit the war in Iraq now that victory is finally in sight. And Barack Obama responds to that by giving a ringing endorsement of the surge, which was the trademark policy of the Bush administration. So you have this sort of dialectical do-say-do going on between these two partners who are really evenly matched, and neither of which is a firmly defined ideological alternative to the other. They're both very much in the same mold where it comes to supporting interventionist foreign policy and socialist administration of the economy here at home and the enrichment of these permanent corporate oligarchies that exist that are in symbiosis with the permanent political oligarchy. Of course, Mr. Obama has surrounded himself by the likes of the folks who brought us a lot of the really ugly business in the investment markets, and the derivatives markets. Mr. Biden, Barack Obama's running mate, is somebody who could be considered the senator from MBNA, the credit card agency. His son, Beau Biden, who is the, I believe, assistant attorney general in Delaware, and I believe he's also a member of the Army Reserve. He's currently stationed in Iraq. From what I understand, he's helping to build the legal infrastructure of that country, the post-Ba'athist legal infrastructure. And if they want instruction on how to run a decent and rationally ordered legal system, they really ought to turn to somebody other than somebody surnamed Biden. But Mr. Beau Biden, Joe Biden's son, worked for MBNA, and it's interesting to note that both Biden and Barack Obama were instrumental in bringing about this absolutely horrible Bankruptcy Reform Act that went into effect in 2005 that made it almost impossible for people who were legitimately in over their heads to work out an equitable and manageable bankruptcy scheme. I remember in 2005 you had lines snaking up to miles in length at courthouses, county courthouses around the country in the fall of 2005 as people wanted to get in under the wire before the Bankruptcy Reform Act which had been basically written by credit card companies, went into effect. Now, I believe the people ought to make good on their debts. They ought to discharge their obligations. I believe the people ought to do what is necessary in order to make good with their creditors. As like many other people, I've gotten in over my head on occasion and have done what I can to pay off my debts in an honorable way. It's sometimes very frustrating, but these are situations that people are becoming more acquainted with. But you shouldn't have credit card companies writing legislation tailored to their own interests, which is what they managed to do by way of Mr. Biden, and Mr. Obama was in the loop on that as well. And on the other side of the spectrum, of course, you've got John McCain and Sarah Palin, who were very much in the grip of this hyper-militant faction of the neocon movement. And I think that the chief accomplishment that has been wrought here by putting Sarah Palin on this ticket is finding some way to rivet...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Go right ahead, because William is talking about the fact that both John McCain and Sarah Palin seem to be closely affiliated with the neocons. Certainly we find that William Kristol, who is one of the leaders of the neocon movement, had actually some months ago, or several weeks ago anyway, suggested Sarah Palin would be the ideal vice presidential candidate. And now, of course, McCain and Palin, closely affiliated with the neocon movement. Pick the story up there.
Yeah. The most important thing about Mr. Kristol in this respect is that he's got an interesting track record in picking running mates. He was more or less the dark eminence behind Dan Quayle. He was somebody who had known Dan Quayle for a long time. I believe he had served on Dan Quayle's staff when Mr. Quayle was in the Senate from Indiana, but he was somebody who had really promoted Quayle and also served as Quayle's chief of staff, I believe, when Mr. Quayle was vice president. And it was on the basis of that association that William Kristol began to develop his own network that led him to the point where he could found the Weekly Standard and become a talking head presence on Fox News. And now, of course, he sits in the august company of the others who disfigure public opinion from the editorial page of the New York Times. Mr. Kristol has been consistently wrong on every issue of consequence, but he has had a great deal of influence in terms of Republican Party politics.
Well, don't forget, of course, that the Weekly Standard, which, of course, William Kristol is the editor, was largely funded by a man named George Soros.
George Soros is in, Rupert Murdoch and George Soros.
I'm sorry, Rupert Murdoch. I apologize. It was Rupert Murdoch who was actually behind that. Go ahead.
Yeah, Rupert Murdoch is an Australian expatriate who's a naturalized American citizen, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, married to a woman from China who's part of the Red Chinese princeling caste, that is to say somebody who's connected by virtue of high-ranking party membership and military connections to the elite that rule the country and that control its economy. And Rupert Murdoch is somebody who is very much a neocon in his worldview. He's completely without principle, utterly flexible, to the point of being almost like an acrobat from the Cirque du Soleil when it comes to fitting his ambitions to his available resources. He's, just, like I said, just completely without standards or a canon of behavior. And the Weekly Standard is the house organ of the neoconservative movement right now, and they're very much in favor of an interventionist government here at home and also an interventionist government abroad. And Sarah Palin, I think, was talent scouted a number of years ago as somebody from an evangelical Christian background who is very telegenic and capable of great wit and charm and spontaneous eloquence in certain settings, somebody who brings with her a compelling narrative and a compelling regional identity, but who was receptive to the entreaties of the neocon movement. I think 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, she was much more authentically conservative in a constitutionalist sense than she is now. And her primary purpose, as I started to say before the last break, I believe, is to rivet the evangelical right to the McCain campaign as a way of propelling McCain into the White House, or at least making this campaign very competitive. I really think at this point, barring some huge disclosure that really undermines the ticket, that McCain and Palin have a better than average chance of actually pulling this out and winning. because Barack Obama, for all of his superficial charm, is something of an unknown quantity with which the public is not entirely comfortable. I think a couple of days ago, in discussing Barack Obama with a friend of mine, I said, he's like somebody who is a charming stranger who contracts a business proposition with you, and then he promises, in exchange for your investment, to pay you by way of a post-dated check. You don't know enough about the guy to know whether you can trust him to give you a post-dated check. Whereas John McCain is somebody with spotty credit history who is seen as more reliable, be it simply because he has a history that is a little bit more detailed and you know his weaknesses and strengths, if any. And I think in the current environment, economically and politically, that people are not really going to be all that willing to put their faith in the charm of somebody who remains largely enigmatic, as Mr. Obama does, and instead they might find themselves gravitating toward the more comfortable option, who is John McCain. But in terms of substance, there just really isn't a whole lot that separates the two of them. Witness the fact that one of the first things that happened after Sarah Palin was when she was selected by McCain to stand for the nomination to be the vice president's running mate, is the two of them went this past Monday and convened a meeting with AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee. That is a large organ, which is an agent of a foreign government that has an interest in maintaining the interventionist foreign policy that is undermining our national independence.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest, of course, is William Griggs. So, William, go right ahead with the story.
I was mentioning that this past Monday, just days after Sarah Palin was introduced to a national audience as Mr. McCain's choice to be vice presidential running mate, the two of them met in a hotel with a rather large contingent from the American Israel Political Action Committee, or AIPAC. AIPAC is an agent of a foreign government, in the same sense that there are organizations that represent the government of Russia or China or Mexico. AIPAC represents the interests of Israel, at least what they are pleased to call the interests of Israel. I think they have badly misread the interests of the people of Israel. They represent the government of Israel, and in most cases, this one is no exception, the interests of the government are sharply divergent from those of the people of the country in question. But the point is, whatever you think of AIPAC's take on what Israel's interest would be, its position on what American foreign policy should be is bad for the interests of the United States, because they are very much interested in maintaining a highly visible interventionist foreign policy on behalf of Washington. They're very much interested in maintaining foreign aid, primarily, of course, for the Israeli government, but also for governments that are seen as, in some sense, either peace partners or at least potential coalition partners with Israel. There is an arrangement of parity, thanks to the 1978 Camp David Accords, between Israel and Egypt. Egypt, by the way, is a country I visited, is ruled by a perfectly loathsome regime, but they receive near parity, very near parity, in foreign aid with Israel. And Israel also has, as strange as it may seem, a distant and somewhat frigid but serviceable understanding with the government of Saudi Arabia, which, of course, you would suspect would have nothing but unfiltered hostility for Israel. The Saudi Arabian government has a very large and very powerful lobby in Washington as well, and for reasons that superficially one would assume have to do with the strategic necessity of containing Iran, which is a Shiite power, Israel has entered into sort of a modus vivendi with Saudi Arabia, which of course is a Sunni Islamic power and considered to be the bane enemies of the Shiite regime in Iran. Israel also has very cordial relations with Ankara, with Turkey, which is another Islamic state. And it also has a large and growing interest in Georgia, the country in the Caucasus, which used to be part of the Soviet Union, which is the site right now of what could eventually become a regional war implicating the interests of Russia and the United States.
Hold that thought right there, please. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess William Gregan. William is simply pointing out a lot of the inconsistencies of what's going on there, and pointing out that there is a relationship, perhaps a little difficult, but a strain, but certainly a very cordial relationship in many ways, respects behind the scenes between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Now, that is very strange because, of course, Saudi Arabia is the major funder of this whole world Islamic terrorist movement that is intent upon destroying Israel. Then, of course, William talks about the relationship between Israel and Egypt. And, of course, there's certainly a relationship that has existed there for a long time between Israel and this corrupt government in Egypt, which is being financed regularly by the United States to the tune of about $3 billion a year. Then there's a relationship between Israel and the Islamic government in Turkey. So nothing is quite as it appears to be. You pick the story up there. But before we do, William,
right,
I do want you to tell our listeners how they can get your blog site, how they can get other information that you're offering today.
I appreciate that. My blog is called Pro Libertate. I try to publish a new essay on that blog between 3 and 5 times a week, and my essays are usually between 1,200 and 2,000 words. That's just a word of the wise. If you don't have an appetite to read something that long, that's a little bit involved, you might find what I have to say challenging. And if you're somebody who's a fairly conventional Republican, you're going to find what I have to say fairly challenging, because I'm not beholden to the nostrums and shibboleths of contemporary conservative republicanism. I'm a constitutionalist. I describe myself as a Christian libertarian, for lack of a better way of describing my convictions. The most important thing to recognize is that libertarian modifies the kind of Christian I am politically. The most important thing, of course, is that I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian believer. That's the fundamental basis that I use to assess any decisions that are made in my life or by those who purport to represent me in government. And Pro Libertate focuses on issues of individual freedom and the all-encompassing assault on individual freedom by government. To find Pro Libertate, the easiest way that you should proceed will be to go to the homepage of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. And the web address for The Right Source is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. At the top of the page, if you go to The Right Source, you'll find a banner ad for my most recent book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. It's about 300 pages long, and it deals with many, many examples and treats with many, many of the subterranean issues that are implicated in our country's descent into police state tyranny. This has been going on for a number of decades. It obviously radically accelerated after September 11, 2001. But if September 11th hadn't happened, we'd be in a place pretty similar to where we are right now. Such were the trends that have been put in place by the people who are proceeding with stealthy, muffled tread in the direction of gaining total power over our lives. That can be ordered, my new book, Liberty and Eclipse, by clicking through the ad there at the top of the page of The Right Source. It can be ordered through Radio Liberty. It's also available through Amazon.com. And if you're looking at the homepage of the Welch Foundation, if you scroll down about a third of the way down the screen, look at the left-hand side of the page, you'll find my photograph. I'm a large brown fellow with a Van Dyke beard, in case you've never seen a picture of me. There's a hyperlink right next to my photograph that will take you to my blog, Pro Libertate. And I want to emphasize something here about the way that I cover issues in my blog. I'm always trying to find ways of approaching issues, once again, from the perspective of individual liberty protected by law, defined by God's law. And that means that I'm not taking anything for granted in terms of a lot of the settled opinions that conservatives have had about, for instance, how the military should operate, the type of position we should take with respect to wars that our government gets our country involved in, with respect to the claims that are made by people who are exercising political power, whether you're talking about the federal government or the local government. I think it's all up for grabs. I'm always looking at what's going on and asking why we put up with certain impositions upon liberty. And in doing so, I offer opinions occasionally that people will be very tempted to describe as liberal in the contemporary sense of that expression. because they're directly contradictory to what the conservatives are doing today. What I contend is that the conservatives of today are, for the most part, collectivist. They are statist in their outlook. They don't think in terms of what the Constitution defines as the very limited role that government should play in our lives, the peripheral role that government should assume. And so, in spite of the fact that I frequently find myself, even among friends and family, being asked why I've turned liberal, I've never changed my mind about the primacy of the Constitution and the singular importance of individual human liberty. What's happened is that a number of us who are conservatives of the old school, you know, the Robert Taft and Frank Chidora school, have remained consistent in our defense of individual liberty, while the so-called conservative movement under the leadership of the neocons right now has become thoroughly statist and collectivist and distorted what conservatism used to be into a type of truculent socialist nationalism. And so if you read Pro Libertate, if you come at this from the perspective of somebody who's been listening to some of the larger so-called mainstream conservative talking heads on television or some of the radio personalities we're all familiar with, you might be struck by the difference that you'll discern between the way I approach issues and the way that they approach issues. All I ask is that if you read what I have to say and you disagree with it, that you go into the comment thread and explain to me where I'm wrong. And if I'm wrong, I'll admit it, because I reserve unconditionally the right to become more intelligent about any issue, and the only way I can do that is if somebody shows me where I'm wrong and does so convincingly.
Oh, I think it's so important, though, that people understand, our listeners understand, the neoconservatives who are dominating the conservative movement today are Trotskyites.
Yes, they're Marxists.
They're Marxists, and that is why they want big government and why they want wars and why they certainly want to extend a certain surveillance over all of our citizens. Until people understand that neoconservatives are Trotskyites, and if you haven't, of course, gotten my material, it's up on my webpage, the certain speeches given by Congressman Ron Paul that goes into the background of what the neoconservatives are. Go to RadioLiberty.com. Understand the neoconservatives who control the Bush administration are certainly Marxist Trotskyites, followers of the teachings of Leon Trotsky. At that point, you begin to understand what's really going on today, but you're never going to hear that from the general controlled media. So go right ahead, William.
Yeah, and that's, once again, a matter of transcendent importance. If you understand the role that warfare plays in transforming a society in a collectivist direction, you'd understand why people like myself, who are conservative in terms of our approach to the preservation of the permanent things, are so opposed to warfare when it is unnecessary. My belief is that there are times when it is necessary to fight to defend those things for which you are responsible. You're talking about your home, your family, your freedoms, your community. Those things are worth protecting, even to the point of bloodshed. But the foreign wars that our government has been involved in since 1917, no later than 1917, you make a good case that since 1848 our government's been involved in needless foreign conflicts. But no later than 1917 our government got involved in foreign wars overseas, in conflicts that had no plausible connection to the defense of our country from foreign aggression. And if you go back and take a look at the writings of Marx after the founding of the Communist International in the mid-19th century, there was a quote, and I'm going to paraphrase it as closely as I can from memory, in which Marx said to his followers, "It will take at least two generations of warfare to transform you into the type of people that are going to be necessary to carry out the revolution." In other words, Marx enjoyed and he enjoined an effort to bring about a permanent state of warfare in order to create the type of society, the type of statist, collectivist society that would be compatible with his objectives. If you take a look at the teachings of James Madison, who was at the opposite pole from Marx on every matter of consequence, in 1795, Madison warned that of all the enemies of public liberty, war is the most to be feared, because it engenders, or rather, it possesses and develops the germ of every other. War, he said, is the parent of armies, and from armies proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. And he also pointed out that in warfare, the power of the executive is enhanced and expanded. in ways that are injurious to Republican institutions and individual liberty. So Madison understood what war does. Marx understood what war does. That's why Madison was generally disinclined toward war, and Marx wanted to engage in war at any provocation and on any pretext. And the neoconservatives who define the conservative movement today, the ones who pick Sarah Palin as a stalking horse to bring the disaffected conservative base into McCain's campaign as foot soldiers on behalf of getting him elected, the neoconservatives being disciples of Leon Trotsky, or, more appropriately put, being disciples of those who followed Leon Trotsky, they're people who are, broadly speaking, Marxist in their orientation. They believe in a permanent revolution the way that Leon Trotsky did. That was the difference that separated him from Joseph Stalin. Stalin wanted to build socialism in one country, and he opportunistically got involved in wars that helped to expand the dominions of the Soviet Empire. Leon Trotsky was the creator of the Red Army. He believed that the purpose of the Soviet regime should be one of evangelizing the world at the point of the sword, the point of the bayonet, on behalf of Marxist ideals. And one of the Marxist ideals that's talked about in the Communist Manifesto, you can look it up, is to bring about socialism by, quote, winning the war for democracy. Democracy as an ideal is always used as a precursor for the imposition of socialism. There are small-d democratic functions in a republic. For instance, we have majority votes for a lot of elected offices. You could say that those are small d democratic mechanisms. I mentioned how the jury is an exercise of democracy. But of course, these things are all limited by law. Democracy as a uniform system is always a precursor to some kind of collectivism, because the majority starts determining how the entire society will be run in defiance of set laws that protect the interests of the individual. So in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels were talking about winning the war for democracy, and of course that's the great refrain of the neocons today. We have to be going out and promoting democracy at the point of a cruise missile. And you saw these delirious, self-enraptured orations being given by George Bush and Condoleezza Rice at the beginning of the second term of the Bush administration, talking about the global democratic revolution. As a matter of fact, in his second inaugural address, George W. Bush used the expression, "We have lit a fire in the minds of men." Now that was a really provocative phrase for a number of reasons. The phrase is actually taken from a novel written by the Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky called The Devils. And it talks about the way that conspiratorial agitators in Russia, working with a group that was inspired by Marx and that could trace its lineage back to a group called the Illuminati back in Bavaria in 1776, these conspiratorial revolutionaries basically ignited a revolution in a town. They went in and they infiltrated a town and started agitating to overthrow the existing institutions. And at one point, there are fires that are tearing through the streets of this little village. And one of the characters said, "No, the fire is not on the roofs. The fire is in the minds of men." And that, of course, was a phrase that was taken by James Billington as the title for his book, A Fire in the Minds of Men, The Origins of the Revolutionary Faith. Mr. Billington, I don't know if he is still the Librarian of Congress, but he's been Librarian of Congress twice. He's also been an Aspen Institute scholar and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, so he's not a John Bircher in terms of his affiliations, but his book is a scholarly study of how, beginning with the Illuminati and working through the occultic networks of secret societies, this revolutionary faith has been propagated that ended up coalescing into Marxism and the modern revolutionary movement, of whom the neocons were a part. And suddenly you have this expression, which is a term of art from this conspiratorial underworld. Dostoevsky had been part of it at one point in his life. He'd actually been sentenced to prison in Siberia for his revolutionary activities. He was literally at the point of being killed by a firing squad when his death sentence was commuted. He was sent to Siberia, and he used a lot of his literature to expose what these conspirators were doing in Russia. But this term of art, fire in the minds of men, actually ended up being uttered by a president of the United States who's too big of a numbskull to know perhaps the significance of what he was saying, But his speechwriters certainly knew what they were putting in his mouth.
And let me just comment, we do carry the book. We think it's a very important book, and we actually gave a whole talk based upon that. It's called World Revolution, because the fire in the minds of men of this world revolutionary movement, of course, is responsible for that. You'll actually hear, if you get that DVD, Fire in the Minds of Men, you'll hear my interview with Ambassador Earl Smith, who was the American ambassador to Cuba at the time of the revolution, who will tell you that they brought the State Department and the CIA brought Fidel Castro to power, knowing full well he was a communist. And, of course, he talks about how this revolution had begun with the French Revolution, and it concluded at that time, at the time of the writing of the book, Fire in the Minds of Men, had concluded with the Cuban Revolution. And, of course, we brought a known communist to power. So it's a fascinating DVD. Let me recommend it to you.
Yeah.
World Revolution. We have the only interview I know of with Ambassador Smith. Go right ahead, will you?
Yeah, but it's just so fascinating to me that you have this man, George W. Bush, who is considered to be a Christian conservative, and who for most of his term was treated with slack-jawed, misty-eyed adoration by the evangelical right, in his second inaugural address, uttering that phrase in the context of talking about fighting this global revolution, using the United States military as a globe-straddling power to promote democracy through aggression and military occupation. When I heard that speech, I said, good grief, we're talking about the Bushnev Doctrine. It's almost as if George W. Bush had somehow become a hybrid of Bush and Leonid Brezhnev, who was the head of the Soviet Union during their last great evangelizing period of the 1960s to the late 1970s, when they claimed the right to promote the Soviet doctrine of democratic totalitarianism through military aggression and occupation, and the right to invade a country that threatened to leave the socialist consensus of the Soviet bloc, which is what happened in Czechoslovakia in 1968. If you flash forward to 2005, during the second inaugural address of George W. Bush, suddenly all of these objectives have been transposed into the American idiom, and we got a fully functioning revolutionary regime in Washington, and the Palin nomination was a masterstroke intended to rivet the Christian right to the McCain candidacy in order to perpetuate that revolutionary ideology.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it was an ingenious stroke, really. I mean, she'll get a lot of the women's vote who will vote for her simply because she's a woman. She'll get the evangelical vote simply because, of course, she is purports to be an evangelical. But not only that, McCain will get all the moderate vote because, of course, you can't really tell he's a Republican or a Democrat.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was certainly, I think, a masterful stroke. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Griggs to wrap up tonight's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
As you always say, Dr. Stan, illusion, not reality, is king. At least where the mass media, the organs of mass misinformation are concerned. And if you watched the two conventions of the two outlets, the retail outlets for the establishment party these last couple of weeks, you've really gotten a full dose of thoroughly scripted and choreographed illusion, whether you're talking about the apotheosis of Saint Barack Obama as he ascended to his little tableau there, where he was flanked by Doric columns and greeted with literally rhapsodic, worshipful reverence by his audience, or whether you saw tonight's speech by John McCain, where like Coriolanus in the Shakespearean play, he was talking about his wounds as the stigmata of his heroism and his worthiness to lead. And in both instances, you had people who were presenting themselves as the embodiment of a messianic promise, as the embodiment of the messianic state. He had the same message being delivered to two different audiences with very minor variations in tone and no really noticeable divergences in substance. And that's why people have to understand that when we are being stampeded to support one or the other, the same people behind the scenes will always benefit. We have to do something about reducing the power that Washington exercises. We have to take power back from Washington. As a matter of fact, we have to take power back from City Hall. We have to take power back from everybody who presumes the right to lead, to regiment, to command us. We have to rebuild our own autonomous institutions as individuals and families, and we have to find like-minded people to prepare for the coming and unfolding disaster that is going to strip away from us every pretense of being a free and prosperous society. That time is coming very soon. We have to prepare for it, and it will be a crisis and an opportunity, a crisis in the sense that it will bring about horrible changes, an opportunity in the sense that it will break up the status quo and give us an opportunity to restore that which has been taken from us.
I agree with you totally. I think we're entering a very, very difficult time, a time of crisis and chaos, and I think it's so vitally important that people understand that behind what's going on are the powerful spiritual forces that have been here since the inception of mankind and, of course, are being played out now today in the political battlefield. That the eternal battle fought on a political, ideological, cultural battlefield, but it's always a spiritual battle. William, thank you so very much. We'll look forward to talking to you next week. I'm going to be off for the weekend and down in Los Angeles talking. We'll talk to you next week when we get back. I'm looking forward to your views at that time. Thanks so much.
God bless.
You too. Bye-bye. And that was William Craig. Well, Dr. Stan, we hope you enjoyed William Grigg. We always enjoy him. He's certainly one of the most articulate spokesmen we have in the conservative movement, and we're privileged to have him with us here twice a week, usually on Thursday sometime, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, or Wednesday at 3 o'clock, and then, of course, on our Friday evening program. Well, certainly we'd like to mention, of course, that we carry the book Fire in the Minds of Men by James H. Bellington, written by a liberal member of the Council on Foreign Relations, but a very worthwhile book. Then we have, of course, my DVD based upon that book entitled World Revolution. That's World Revolution. Introduces you to the Illuminati. It's not imaginary, it's real. And James H. Bellington tells you all about it as it existed back in the period preceding the French Revolution. Then, of course, if you really want to understand what's going on today, you need my talk, Iraq, The Untold Story. You need my talk on the sustainable development. Remember, these all come with syllabuses. The Forbidden Secret comes with a syllabus. The Planned Police State comes with a syllabus. We have a number of talks, a number of syllabuses, which we recommend to you because, of course, they have a lot of documentation. Now, if you would like to help Radio Liberty, because I believe the only way to reach people is by certainly radio. We buy time on many radio stations across the country. We're fortunate that we have almost over 60 now, approaching 65 outlets across America. A lot of them are half-hour a week. Some of them are every day. But we need to reach more and more people in the areas where we have our programs. People's attitudes are changing. So if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters and your position to help, our number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there are seriously considering coming to the all-day seminar on the 26th of October, going to be held here in the North Shore of Monterey Bay. We'll be serving lunch. We had almost 150 last year. We hope we can do again that well, in fact, even better. We bring in some wonderful guests, Dr. Blaylock, Joanna Michelson, Patrick Woods, Michael Shaw will be here. It will be a great day and a great deal of information. So if you can come bring some friends, the number to call, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we also hope that you'll go to our website of radioliberty.com, that you'll actually watch our DVDs, that you'll listen to our radio programs, that you'll read our newsletters. There's a section there that tells about all the books and the DVDs and certainly videos and tape sets and CD sets we have available. And if you buy those, and they're the ones that we produce, you have our permission to copy them and get them out. We need you to help us get people thinking and understanding. We have one political party with two branches. One's the Republicans, the other's the Democrat, and it's all showbiz. It's rhetoric over reality, symbolism over substance. And certainly we do hope that you, if you have never heard our four-tape set on the secret societies, If you've never heard our four tapes out on the secret government or gotten our secret government special, you'll get that information. We've got great four tape or four CD set on the Bilderbergers. We've got a four tape set on the Bohemian Grove. We've got a four tape set on Masonry. And, of course, on these secret societies that exist out there working within the shadows. So that's Bilderbergers, the Bohemian Grove, our four tapes out on the secret government gets into the Council on Foreign Relations, and you'll actually hear a two-hour interview with Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, as he talks about how his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, was actively suppressed. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, there are people out there who have a different worldview. They want to bring about a world government. They want to bring about a world religion. They want to bring about a world leader because they worship a different God. Because behind all of this are powerful spirits or forces, and of course that's why you need to get our material. And if you ask for the workings of the spiritual hierarchy and get into the other material, we'll be glad to send it to you. Please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.